Welcome to the Inclusion First podcast, where we amplify the stories of regular people practicing anti-racism in their everyday lives. Every single one of us has the ability to create real and meaningful change right where we are. I'm your host, Carrie Sawyer, and I've got the stories to prove it. I can't wait to introduce you to these people, these change leaders, people who saw a need and decided to take action. To me, this is so inspiring, showing the powerful idea of everyday activism. I hope that you take away at least some small inspiration and use it to act and create more good in your world too. Let's get started, y'all. Here we are, another episode of the Inclusion First podcast. I'm excited to introduce you to another amazing guest. And this person I actually intersected with through work when I was doing some community liaising between my company and nonprofits in the city of San Diego. And she is so smart, so funny, so amazing, so authentic, and really not afraid to have the hard conversations, no matter who is in the room. And so I really admire and respect her for all of those amazing qualities. And so I can't wait to introduce you to her right now. Our guest today, her name is Sarah Tuwakli Cooper. Fun fact about Sarah is that she is trained in theater and composition and spent 20 years teaching music composition and production in her hometown of London before coming to San Diego in 2008. She has two older sons living in the UK and one daughter here, a high school student in San Diego. Since moving to the U.S., Sarah has established a wide network of friends and colleagues in several nonprofits, including the League of Amazing Programmers, which is where she is currently the executive director. She volunteers for Voices for Children, where she serves as a court-appointed special advocate, and she also teaches relationship building to incoming volunteers at the United Women of East Africa support team. She's the chair of the board of directors there. She also co-chairs Jobs and Education Working Group for the San Diego Promise Zone. So lots and lots of things, very connected into the community, and I'm excited to bring you Sarah and her unique perspectives today. I'm excited for her to share as someone who is from across the pond. I'm excited for her to share as someone who identifies as a multiracial person and a mother and an activist and all these incredible things. So please join me in welcoming Sarah to the Inclusion First podcast. Hi, Sarah. Thank you so much for being here today. How are you doing?
Well, it's always a pleasure to be with you. So I'm doing well on that front. I'm surviving, as is everybody. My daughter sitting in the next room suffering the negative effects of her second shot. There's that. But, you know, generally speaking, yeah, we're doing all right.
Good. Doing okay. Well, I'm glad. Everyone's getting vaccinated, all that. That's not what we're going to talk about today, but that's like a whole other podcast.
It's another, a layer on top of everything.
So I'm super excited to talk with you today about this idea of activism and anti-racism and what it actually looks like in practice and like in our everyday lives. And so the first question that I have for you, Sarah, is what does it mean to you to be an activist in 2021?
I find myself personally to be an accidental activist. I'm the daughter of a very strong activist. My mother, you know, was in everything she could be in to be actively overthrowing the establishment and creating a utopia for us all to live in. You know, she joined CND back when it was in the 50s, and she had us all marching outside Africa House against apartheid when I was a kid. She was a Green MEP candidate trying to stand as a Ecology Party member for the European Union. So she was always very, I've even got shots of her outside the White House. I mean, she would come from London to be activist in the States. So she was very energetically active. And so for me, I don't think of myself as an activist because I'm not nearly as, you know, passionate or as forthright as she was. But I'm accidentally an activist because I can't keep quiet and I can't not stand up for what I see as important. And I think in 2021, what it's come to mean for us is to use our bodies, to not just be, you know, it's not enough for me to sit harumphing on Facebook or arguing with people on Twitter. I have to get out there and be in the places with my body to be considering myself an activist.
I love that. And it made me like six questions exploded my mind all at the same time. The first was like, where are you out there? And how do we manage activism in the era of COVID and social distancing and mask and all these things? Can you speak to the intersection of those?
After the immediate aftermath of the George Floyd murder, it was so interesting to see people tussle with that question, you know, because we had all been terrified into staying in homes and keep trying to be socially distanced and trying to be conscious, you know, and contributing to overcoming this pandemic. It was exactly that set of people that also wanted to get out there and be protesting and making our voices heard. And I did notice that we were careful, you know, we were out marching, but showing respect for personal space, wearing masks. And where you go, as far as I'm concerned, is you have to be in your local vicinity. You have to be showing your friends and neighbours. I say that, and I'm actually, as I say it, I'm thinking I'm a hypocrite. Because it's so much easier for me to go down to Hillcrest and march, you know, than it is for me to come out in El Cajon, where I live, or pop up to Santee and risk getting spat on. It's not something I discuss with my neighbours, you know, my immediate neighbours. I don't tend to have those conversations. But when I say locally, I mean in San Diego, you know, with my local community. I think it's really important that we establish commonalities with real people, not just kind of joining with the abstract sense of outrage, but have connected conversations with real people as we're doing our activism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So for the people who say, Sarah, like, I don't march, I don't feel safe being out there, is that the only form of activism? What other ways can I be an activist?
I can remember going and having to actually, you know, cut the flyers and put them into the mailboxes. But there are ways to spend your money, for a start. You know, you can be intentional about how you spend your money, who you give your money to. You can be supportive of other people's activism. You don't necessarily have to go and put yourself in danger or at risk, and that be the only way that you support marches, for example. Spreading the word. Having conversations. I mean, when you have a conversation with someone, particularly if it's with someone that kind of doesn't agree with you or they're offset at an angle from what you believe, I think that's a really valuable thing to be doing. Not so that you can win, but so that you can stimulate thought and context and questions. I don't think it's necessarily just marching around, but it's actively taking an action.
Yeah, I think it's a super important point that you made about having conversations with people who may believe or think differently than you, and not so that you win is what you said. It's not about winning or smashing their ideas or convincing them necessarily to believe the same way that you believe, but it's that process and that dialogue where the richness comes out, and not just for them, because understanding an alternate viewpoint creates sparks in your mind too, whether those sparks strengthen, you know, the argument that you already had, or creates new ideas or new possibilities that maybe you hadn't considered before, as we're working to connect as human beings and to develop our empathy and develop our communication skills through, you know, through this topic of race and racism and anti-racism and what that is manifesting out in the world today.
One of the things that you said brought an image into my mind of if you encounter someone with a different viewpoint from yours, what is it that's going to have them listening to you? What's going to cause them to listen to you? It won't be proof. It won't be facts. It will be what sense of feeling you have of a shared humanity, right? What sense you manage to give them that they are safe, that they're respected, that they have dignity, and that you're not there to belittle them, even if you're challenging their ideas. So helping other people to hear what you're saying by coming at it in the right frame of mind, you know, bringing an authentic desire to understand them, not just making the sounds of I want to hear you, but actually listening, you know.
Yeah, because you can feel how open the person is that you're talking to. Like, you can feel if they're listening, you can feel if this is an exchange or just a one-up thing that's happening. I mean, we've all had those conversations where we know going into it that we're not going to get anywhere. Yeah. So we know what that feels like. So kind of turning that on its head and you know, communicating with respect. And I got to talk with our friend Howard, and he had a similar sentiment around, you know, the calm approach.
Absolutely. Yeah. It really exemplifies that, I think. That ability to take a breath before anything, you know, is constantly a calm approach. And I think also the thing that I noticed this week, as I was saying, I've had quite a few arguments this week, in air quotes, but if you can approach an argument calmly, even if you don't persuade the other person within the duration of the argument, 9 times out of 10, they will go away and think about what you said. Whereas if you just made them angry, they'll go away and be thinking about how angry you made them.
Yeah, that's very true. And when they're thinking about what you said, the wheels are turning. And the next time you talk, who knows what what will transpire, but something will have likely moved in that conversation.
And the truth is, I've had to try and understand things that I've got no vested interest in understanding. You know, I don't have a vested interest in understanding why somebody has 180 degree viewpoint from mine, other than somehow coming to a meeting place. You know, I've had very, very many relationships where I've been the only Black person that somebody knows, and it's much easier for me to understand why they're racist or where their racism started or how it operates, you know, in their whole framework of thinking. It's much easier for me to understand it than it is for them to understand it. So between us, maybe we can tackle it. We can get down to the bottom of it.
Yeah, they're the fish in the water. They don't feel wet. It's normal. So, Sarah, you mentioned your daughter earlier, and I would love to touch on the idea of like activism in the home. Like, how does that manifest for you? If you're open to sharing, how does it manifest like at home?
As I said, I was a child of a very activist person, and it's kind of funny because now I'm the mother of one. I think the reason that they are both more energetically active than me is because I'm actually quite a lazy person. You know, I'm happy to sit in my armchair and watch the TV. But this last couple of years, I've had to be the driver and get out and be the protector. I wasn't ever going to prevent my daughter from being places where she needed to be to express her feelings or to learn more or to be with her friends. She's 16 now, just 16. So, you know, that's the generation. I think of them as the generation that's right because they have no idea that they're not right. I mean, they're just, you know, completely convinced. They're 100% convinced that they're right all the time. But also, you know, when I actually think about it, they are. They're not wrong. Adults are crap, you know. Well, they're not interested in the excuses or the compromises or the historical reasons, how it came to be like this. They just want it to change and they want it to be, you know, they want to solve the problems. And I love that about this generation, that energy that they bring. You know, it needs to be tempered by wisdom and resources from outside sometimes. But they give me hope that we're going to be going in the right direction for the duration.
I am always heartened by my interactions with young people and how they're thinking, how they're solving problems, what they're already creating. It's amazing. And, you know, this idea that the world is going to shit, it's not true because of them and other good people and good things that are happening too. But, you know,
they're not in the news much, but they're doing an awful lot. And so in terms of activism in the home, you know, books, what we're watching, the culture we're consuming, the conversations we're having, when people can come round, the people that we're having round, you know, even if they have to sit on the back porch. Those conversations also with the families of her friends that might be, you know, less involved or interested than we are, it's still interesting to have those conversations with people who are not particularly active in other households.
Are there any examples that you can share or even high level of kind of what that experience has been like in, you know, talking with parents or maybe even, you know, all of you together about some of these issues and kind of seeing that space between engagement and what's going on?
As I said, we live out in East County. Ella has friends who have parents who are very different than her mum, you know, parents who have very different life experience and set of political beliefs and so on. The fact that we can get together and I can just be someone that they haven't experienced before, you know, for families who have assumptions and have had negative things to say about Black people all their lives, and then all of a sudden there is one in their front room that they can't help liking and enjoying and who is willing to go there and have that conversation, you know, and say, don't you think that's a bit racist? Or I wonder how you arrived at that viewpoint. It can be a little bit embarrassing for the kids at first, but if you've had like a glass of wine or two, it makes that conversation much easier. If you've had three or four, it's probably not a good idea.
This sounds like a tip sheet that we should create.
At which point in the drunken journey to start having a conversation about politics? And it's always framed as political. It's always like, you know, we're pretending that I am a liberal and you're a whatever the opposite is. It's not even Republican anymore, is it? But yeah, we've got friends who have those flags with the blue stripe on it, you know, and you have to have the All Lives Matter conversation without getting cross on two glasses of wine. It's navigating. The whole thing is navigating.
Yeah, for sure. So do you think that you get any extra leeway because you are from across the pond and you have this delightful accent that all Americans love? I mean, I love it. I'm not going to lie. But we were talking about this earlier. Yeah. Say more about that. And
100%. Yeah. It's become my job, actually, is to go and be unexpectedly, surprisingly Black in places where, you know, I evoke on the phone or in a conversation, I'm evoking two dissonant things in the mind of the person that I'm talking to. So they're hearing Downton Abbey, you know, or Bridgerton. Let's go Bridgerton this time. They don't really know what to do with what they're seeing in the same token. So I get to take risks or say things that other people don't get to say. I get to be very explicit about being Black. And especially being Black in America, a lot of people say to me, oh, I've never met an English African-American. And I say, there is not an African-American. I'm African and I'm English, but I'm not American. You know, but they're frightened to use the word Black. So it kind of lets some light in and some breathing room in for us to have a conversation about that, supposedly about, you know, how weird it is for me to have an English accent. I think it means that I get to probe people's feelings about it more. They're more honest with me. They're not guarding mm-hmm. what they're going to say.
It's kind of like your superpower. Yeah. Not the only one, but like in the lunch pail, it's one of them, because it's disarming for people. And because of the dissonance, that is taking up space in their mind versus the defense mechanisms, the like anger, the, all the things that would normally just come out. They're like, what, you know?
Right. So the usual script doesn't apply and they don't know what to do. Huh? So they have to take their cues from me. And because I'm over familiar anyway, as a person, you know, and they're willing to be led because I sound kind of BBC and kind, you know. I can get away with being quite mean or quite, you know, rude to people. So, yeah, I'm making a lot of use of that over here. It's a responsibility. If you've got that trick, it's a responsibility to go out and use it.
I mean, I'm not mad. I'm not. I think that we have to use all the tricks that we have in this journey that we're on. So talked about activism at home and a couple different generations worth of that. What about activism at work? What does that look like for you? And I know that you're at the League of Amazing Programmers doing amazing things. And at this time, it feels like you're being challenged. I mean, I don't know. I would just imagine being in your role as the executive director, like being at the League, and what do you do with all this information? Everything that's happening and managing, running any organization during this time has to be completely crazy.
It's been exhausting, actually. My staff is really depleted, 15 months in. The first 6 months was 3 months. The first 3 months we thought we were going to manage it. And then the summer explosion of feelings happened, you know, anger and outrage and what can we do? And lots of energy being expended. And here we are, we're still trying to manage this pandemic thing. Plus everything we now can't pretend we don't know. And can't not have conversations about. So there are a lot of things that have become explicit or revealed in my role that before we were managing to have a subtext, but now it can't be subtext. It's got to be up the front. One of those things is that I'm the Black person in the organization, which makes it very difficult for me not to, so, you know, I want to promote diversity, equity, inclusion, accessibility, and so on. And now that we're talking about it, the fact of me being Black is a contributing factor to that. Whereas before, everyone was just very polite about it. But now I'm not prepared to put up with any crap from people. And I've been given a way to, you know, more ways to open that conversation. But it is a big emotional and mind suck some of the time, because, you know, the work doesn't go away just because you now got this additional set of things that you need to be dealing with. All of the operational day-to-day boring stuff happens, and now we also want to be paying attention to the fact that we're not doing enough in tech to sort out this digital inequity, and we're not doing enough in tech to make sure that our future workforce reflects our actual population. We're not doing enough to be careful about artificial intelligence, about which there's nothing artificial or intelligent. So suddenly I feel like I've got to fix the world by sorting out this generation of tech builders and entrepreneurs that we're making at the League, making sure that they are empowered, informed, anti-racist, you know, out there saving the planet, stopping climate change, getting rid of all inequity. You know, it's not enough just to do a good job of teaching them to code.
So something that popped in my mind as you were talking was, like, you know, the idea of like coalitions and other partners that you have. Are there other organizations that are like you doing similar things? Are you all talking to each other to see, like, all right, we've got some extra things, we've got some things to do in this space, and working together, or at least sharing what's working, what's not working, can maybe take a little bit of the load off?
That's a really good question. And the answer, fortunately, is yes. We're doing a lot of work together. I think the collaborative impulse really got sparked over this 2020, so that we did applications for grants together with other organizations. But not only that, in the partnership arena, such as down in the San Diego Promise Zone, where the city has a regular working group for across several different topics. I'm in the jobs and education one. We've got a lot of partners that we're working with. Even if it's just to elevate what each other is doing, even if it's to be aware of the work that someone else is doing and make sure that you're not duplicating it or in some way undercutting it when you compete with each other for the same dollars or the same minds, you know. So we're trying to work much more in concert and in coordination, which I think that's going to be a theme going forward, actually, especially with the anti-racist work, is that you can't do it by yourself. You can't do it as one organization. So what are you going to do? You have to find allies, and you have to let people come in and be your ally, even if they don't 100% match you. We have to link arms, you know, and try and move in the same direction.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, even thinking about personal activism and the lessons that you can take from Sarah's experience at the workplace, right? Like, okay, who else cares about the thing that I care about? How do I find them? Even if they're approaching it differently or coming at it from another side where maybe it doesn't seem like the best fit or most natural fit, if our end goals are the same, how can we join together and create a bigger impact, a bigger splash as we're looking at these different issues? And, you know, it's really up to all of us to look around our lives, our work, our homes, and find out where we can create an impact, where we can create new habits, new ways of thinking, anti-racist thoughts, behaviors, actions, all of these things. I would love to know what you all are talking about on the anti-racism front? And does that go into your organization and how you're operating? Is it for the students and the people that you're training, or is it a combination of both of those things?
Well, I think in the past, we were very much kind of traditional nonprofit in that we were doing this. The coding was the top layer of what we did. And then as an act of generosity, we would, you know, offer scholarships. But we didn't see that as central to our mission. It was one of those things where you assume that 10 people are going to do this, so why not let 2 people from under-resourced and underrepresented populations come in and take 2 spaces or 3 spaces or 4 spaces. So very much thinking about this pie that can only be divided up and dished out, and who we're going to keep the biggest part for ourselves, and we're going to give a portion away to make us feel good. I know that's a bit simplistic rendition of it, but I feel like that's been flipped by the students who came in the summer and said, what can we do? We want to make a difference. We want to have an impact. We want to change the world. And they have formed a group called the League Ambassadors, and it's their mission to make sure that we're fostering inclusion in everything that we do. They want to be, you know, they want to be the buddies that go out. They said, we don't like to be rude, but, you know, sometimes it's better if young people talk to young people. Sometimes they're more encouraging, you know. Exactly. Maybe they'll listen to us and believe that they belong in here, you know. So the students themselves are taking action, and all we have to do is facilitate that, make resources available to them. So, you know, they've set up a game night on June the 2nd that is going to have lots of speakers from industry, panelists from industry talking about how you get into the tech industry, but also students sharing their games and showing off and having competitions. So just giving the young people the rope and letting them swing it.
That is incredible. And again, we're back where we started. I'm totally heartened by by young people. They're like, hey, this stuff is going on. It's not okay. And we want to do something. And here's our ideas for that. And just facilitating that activity and that thought and that curiosity and that problem solving is a form of activism.
It is. And that, I think when you said at the beginning, you know, do I have to, I said you have to take your body there and put it there. But really what it is being willing to act. And that includes enabling other people, elevating other people. I think we're less involving ourselves in a quest for individual and moral righteousness, and more in an external, I do want the outside, what's going on out there, to change. And I will do whatever it takes. And that doesn't necessarily mean I have to be in the spotlight or I have to get the credit. It just means that together we have to change something, because this is not working.
Absolutely. So, Sarah, this has been amazing. I have one more question for you as we wrap up our conversation today. So for the people who want to act, but for whatever reason, they haven't. They're afraid. They're not sure what to do. They don't want to do the wrong thing or say the wrong thing. What advice do you give to people to help discover their inner activist?
So there's nothing wrong with an inner journey. It doesn't make it any less valid, and especially at a time when it can be really exhausting putting yourself out there and thinking that you have to meet other people's expectations. I think the first thing you need to do is read something. Because one of the things that I've really benefited from in the last, I mean, I've bought far too many books. Too many books have come out. We've been advised to read too many things. I've got a shelf full of things I haven't read yet. You know, Heather McGee's Some of Us. I managed to get through the How to Be an Anti-Racist. but I've still got like 12 books that I've got to get through. But doing the reading helps you to do the noticing. So you notice more. And then when you notice more, you can point more things out. You can make more observations and you can feel confident that you're not wrong about making those observations. And sometimes that's all it takes, is to make a left turn instead of a right turn in a conversation that you're having with someone, because you've noticed, oh, actually, this is stemming from racism or racist values or racist ideas. And so I feel like if you just want to do some work on yourself, getting some education, this is a really good time for that. There's so much out there to read and to understand. And if you like statistics more than kind of politics, then read something about, I just can't remember the title, but there's a book called No BS, which means no bad stats, about the statistics around, you know, black children in schools and black children in education. It doesn't have to be a, I'm very angry book, you know. There's a book called Cast that puts a much bigger context around the whole differentiation. You know, caste is a thing in India where you have stratas in society, very closely linked to anti-blackness, I have to say, because the darker castes are lower down on the system. But she just does a wonderful job of putting American anti-black racism in context with all sorts of other, you know, problems, race, class, ability, and in a global context. So you don't have to narrow yourself down to a particular field. There's lots of light, fluffy books about racism. But I would say read a book by yourself, and don't feel like you have to prove anything to anyone. You'll still change the world.
I think that's such great advice. And I totally agree the idea of self-reflection. I think that our first step to mitigating and eventually ending racism, it starts with every individual. It starts just with you and how you're thinking, how you're speaking, how you're acting, and what you're putting inside your mind, which is why you're recommending the books, is what helps to shift that. So I think that's great. Sarah, thank you so much for being here today. If people want to follow your work, like follow you, where can they find you?
I'm on LinkedIn, on Sarah Twackley Cooper. I am on Twitter as Square Cooper. And I'm at the League of Amazing Programmers, which our domain name is actually jointheleague.org. So, yeah, you can find me there.
Awesome. Sarah, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Inclusion First podcast. We are always collecting and answering your most important questions on anti-racism. So if there's something on your mind, head on over to the inclusionfirstproject.org and click on Ask a Question. We'd love for you to give us your like, your share, your follow, and especially your review wherever you find us. Thank you so much again for listening, and we will talk to you next time.